Thank you for joining us at the Roundtable.
Brought to you by Community Education Arts, a nonprofit organization based in Noblesville, Indiana.
I'm Alice Cavanaugh Scober, President of CE Arts.
And I'm Sarah E. Morin, Secretary of CE Arts. Let's sit down at the Roundtable.
Thanks for joining us as we continue our discussion of structure in the books Little Women and Jane Eyre. So let's keep talking about structure in Little Women. I think the structure, the linear structure of it, also, again, having first read this book when I was very young, I've always liked a linear structure. We talked about that last time when we were talking about Gone with the Wind and Dracula. And I like that kind of beginning, middle, end of a story. That's just something that I enjoy. And I think of all four of our books, Little Women is kind of like the most straight-up linear storytelling. That said, excuse me while I itch my nose for a second, we do jump from character to character in time almost, but it's still fairly straightforward in chronological time. I think the most notable exceptions to that are when Amy is with Aunt March during Beth's first illness in the chapter called Amy's Will, and then when Beth dies while both Amy and Lori are in Europe in the chapter Learning to Forget. Those two chapters happen after the chapters where Beth was ill, where Beth died. We have to catch up with Amy because we have the first experience of Beth's illness with the people at home, and she's ill with scarlet fever. That's why Amy's been sent off to live with Aunt March to keep her safe. Meg and Joe have already had it or something. Somehow they've already been exposed, right, or something. They've already had it, so they're not at risk. Amy is at risk, so she's sent into quarantine with old mean old Aunt March, you know. And then when Beth actually dies, Amy is in Europe and with Aunt March also. And so those two parts of Amy's story have to be told after the actual events have already happened. We have to play catch up with her. But other than that, and I think there's a little bit also of Joe's time in New York that might kind of be a little timey-wimey, but I feel like the chapters are fairly straightforward chronologically in this book.
Yet I think when Alcott chooses to go slightly out of order chronologically, it's still in order, like the way the overall storyline arcs.
Yes.
It still makes sense with the pacing and the climax of the story. That part still makes sense.
Well, and especially in terms of how, not to be a spoiler for future conversations, but at some point we're going to talk about Amy and Lori's relationship. Mm-hmm. And it is in those two chapters that we understand that Lori, as a friend of the family and as Amy's friend and the family's friend, he is the one that goes to visit her when she's at Aunt March's when Beth is first ill with scarlet fever, and he is the one that goes to her in Europe when Beth has died. And their relationship builds through those crises times where he is there for Amy. When she can't be with her family, physically, literally, he is there. And that helps us accept and understand how they end up being married at the end of the, you know, again, spoiler, you know, Lori doesn't marry Joe. Does anybody in the world not know that? But I don't think I'm spoiling anything. But they end up being, you know, a married couple. And it is, I have always felt like, that was not a shock to me when I first read the book because I'd seen their relationship evolve. It was very obvious to me that, you know, he was there for her and she kind of was there for him in ways that made it clear that they had a bond. And I wasn't all that shocked when they came home married, you know. So, but that's, you know, we'll talk more about Amy and Lori later. But I do feel like the episodic chronological time works really well for the storytelling and the structure of this book.
Right. Yeah, and that is what I was going to go into next, is that it is very episodic.
Yeah.
And we were talking earlier about serialization. Mm-hmm. I do not believe this book was ever serialized.
No, I don't either. It was just the two volumes. Yeah, the two mm-hmm. the two separate books published, I want to say, 2 years apart? 1 year apart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like 68, 69?
Yeah.
1868, 1869.
Yeah.
So, but it could have easily been serialized mm-hmm. in the way it's set up.
Yeah.
Because especially since we're hopping point of view.
Yeah.
It really, like, here's this nice scene where, I feel like we should give spoilers, but the book is so old.
It's like, we might as well just talk about it.
Right. Like, we know that, okay, here's this nice storyline with, Amy burning the book and mm-hmm. the aftermath and falling through the ice with Amy. You know, mm-hmm. it's just a nice, neat episode.
Yeah.
So, it's also quite moralistic in nature.
Yes.
And that is a style which we don't tend to see a lot of today. It is, I don't mind the moralistic nature, but I know that there are people that moralistic nature or moralistic tone would mm-hmm. grate on them. Like, why are you telling me, what are the morals and values I should draw from it? Just tell the story.
Right.
But that was a style of the time, especially
very much
for kids.
And especially in the group of people that Louisa May Alcott was exposed to through her father and the people in literature that she knew. I mean, this was definitely, the whole first chapters of the book when somebody's always talking about Pilgrim's Progress. I mean, these were the books of the day that were upheld as great literature, also great moralistic literature to teach mm-hmm. children how to behave. So that this book, is in that style does not surprise me at all, because this was a very popular style for her time period.
Right. And it does make it for a good read-aloud book, like parent to child.
Yeah.
Because you can kind of, hear in your head as you're reading, I could hear a parent having a nice little moral lesson there.
Yes.
But they can get off because it's in the words of the book.
Right, and isn't that parent then becoming that kind of third-person omniscient narrator in a way?
Yeah.
Or whoever's doing the read aloud. Mm-hmm. And we also have to remember that back in the day, books were read aloud in school to children. And this was probably a very popular book for a very long time in schools throughout the country. I can remember in Georgia in the late 60s, early 70s, in grade school, having the teacher read aloud books to us.
Uh-huh.
And I honestly feel like Little Women was one of those books, but I read it so many times when I was a kid, I couldn't swear to that. It might have just been me reading it, but the teachers read books to us. And so I think you're absolutely right. This is a perfect read-aloud book. Especially for bedtime reading, it has nice, neat, mm-hmm. break, especially with these chapters that have these headings, that kind of tell us a little bit about what the moral is or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so.
Okay, I think that we, did you want to talk a little bit about the domestic experience?
Yeah, I was thinking about this style of writing, how popular it was. And, think of Dickens, almost anything by Charles Dickens, and you're going to have that moral, the morals of the story are quite heavy-handed, if you will. And I agree with you that today's writers they aren't quite so heavy-handed with that. Going back and rereading the book, for me, at almost 57 years of age, it just feels familiar to me. I'm not bothered by that. But imagine you were a, 12 or 13-year-old child picking up this book for the first time today. That, the moralistic tone might feel a little heavy and old-fashioned. So I think we have to acknowledge that this is definitely kind of dated in that way. And I think the chapter that's titled Domestic Experiences, where poor Meg, the new young wife, she learns her lesson about foolish expenditures and pride. That stands out in a very particular way to me as being one of the most moralistic. And, as much as I love Meg and John Brooke getting married, and when I was a kid, the beautiful illustration in the book of their wedding, but then this is like such a woman being doormat chapter. I mean, this is just such a woman in her put woman in her place chapter that it's really uncomfortable nowadays. But I think it's also one of the most heavy-handed in terms of teaching a lesson, if you will. Uh-huh. It is really, it's almost hard to read it in today's, you know, feminist world. Let's hope it's, please let this be a feminist world, but you know what right. I mean? Do you find that? Do you think that's...
I did. Yeah. And going back through both of Meg's starring chapters in Good Wives, the jam one where she's making jam and Jung brings home a dinner guest.
I know. At least I felt sympathy with her on that one. Yeah. You know?
and the earlier one you were alluding to about the expenditures, both of those, I'm like, yep, definitely not a modern read.
Not real comfortable. And part of me wanted her to have that silk for that dress or whatever, you know. I wanted her to have foolish expenditures. Part of me was like, why shouldn't she have pretty things, you know? Right. Just because they're poor, you know. So
it is interesting, the tone, especially of the jam chapter, where she's making a huge mess, which is the way I cook. And there's humor in that, and it makes me in the back of my head question, is Alcott including humor and she agrees with the moral, or is she including humor because she doesn't agree with the moral of her own chapter?
And I think that's a good question, because towards the end of that chapter, I believe that, you know, even though Meg is angry at her husband for bringing this guest home unannounced, and, you know, she's mad because she's a mess, the kitchen's a mess, nothing, you know, and he was thoughtless and all that. I think at the end of that chapter, it's kind of reversed, and he is very kind of, lack of a better word, condescendingly understanding of the position he put her in, but she's the one that kind of ends up feeling like, you know, she shouldn't have been so mean to him, or she shouldn't have been so upset at him, because of course he should bring home whoever he wants, you know. And, you know, it's all was a little, but but. Mm-hmm. I still love Meg and John, and I love the book, so I won't diss it too much, because I mean, as a feminist, you read this, you know, you read this book, and this is one that I think you know, feminists across the board are probably going to be like, well, no. And like I referenced the most recent film adaptation, the jam scene and the domestic experiences scene weren't really in that movie. I mean, they did not include these sort of anti-feminist little women, you know, and I mean little woman, like the little woman, you know, don't worry your pretty little head kind of a thing, that kind of condescending. They didn't even put those scenes in this book, or in that film. So I think that, like a lot of things we're going to be talking about when we talk about TV and film adaptations, we've already discussed some of the differences between Gone with the Wind, the book, and Gone with the Wind, the movie. The stuff that's in a period novel that was written in a certain time period, at a certain time, may have... be a completely different animal than a more recent film adaptation of said story. And I think Little Women is going to be a great example of that, as will Jane Eyre and Dracula and Gone with the Wind. They all are. We're so smart to pick them. Next up, we'll finish our discussion of structure in Little Women. This has been At the Roundtable with Alice
and Sarah E.
of Community Education Arts.
Our nonprofit organization is based in Noblesville, Indiana. You can find us online at cearts.org.
This activity made possible in part with support from the Indiana Arts Commission and the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency.
We'd like to thank James Weston for writing our intro music and for his technical savvy.
Join us next time
at the Roundtable.